This recording is brought to you by the Same Same But Different Writers Festival and PrideNZ.com.
I was very touched early last week when Cole Myers, who's one of the speakers we're going to hear from tonight, one of the new voices, sent me a message, and he said that success for events like this is not measured, quote, in awards or dollars, but in lives touched and made creatively richer and joyous. And I think that's a very important thing. And I think it's something that has motivated all of us in putting together this festival. Our hope, really, with this festival is that it will lead to more. We hope to engage with a wider group of writers, ideally with some coming from overseas. Already we've had quite significant interest from writers from out of New Zealand. And we'd look to engage with thorny contemporary issues that enliven and engage our LGBTQI community. So in a way, this festival, which you're at the very beginning of, is a taster, we hope, for things to come. Thank you so much for all being here on this opening night.
Okay, thank you, Peter. Our first speaker this evening is Joanne Drayton. Joanne is witty, she is smart as a dime, and she is a great talker. Joanne Drayton is an acclaimed biographer of two very different crime writers, Niall Marsh and Anne Perry. Please, ladies and gentlemen, make some noise.
Well, I'm not quite sure whether this qualifies me as a girly swat or a cheat, but I've actually got two books. The two books that I've got here are, and this might prove that a little bit of the girly swat is true, Woman in White. So I'm just going to talk mostly about Woman in White, but also Other Women by Lisa Alther. So Woman in White, just to prove that there's something very special about the real thing. I should show you this book because it says up here Murray Howe High School, and it was presented to Joanne Drayton. Can you believe it? For geography. I knew much more about where I was then than I do now. So for fifth form geography, they really, I think the school didn't know what they were doing when they gave me this book, because in fact, it didn't teach me so much about geography as about perhaps myself. It was wonderful to pull it out again, to look at it, and to actually just realise that I read it twice when I was in the fifth form. Once because I felt like I should, after getting it as a prize, and the second time because I really wanted to relive the experience of reading it. And so, well, it's a book. Well, The Woman in White is a book by Wilkie Collins, and I'll just make sure I'm not going to talk too long. And it's, interestingly enough, I didn't realise this. You know how the weird things, all the bits of your life kind of come together as you get older, and you look at it, and you can start seeing the picture, and you realise where the pieces are missing. But this, well, The Woman in White was actually considered, to be amongst the first, mystery novels. So even then, when I was the geography student at Murray Howe High School, I was interested in mystery novels. And this is one of the first sort of sensation novels. So I got a real sensation, but probably not the one they were intending. It kind of has that sleuthing thing. And it has Walter Hartwright, who has to unravel this mystery about the woman in white, and free the heroine and to marry her. But it's a threesome, actually. And what happens is the woman in white has two women that I think were really, really interesting to me. One was Miriam Halcombe, and the other, of course, was the main character, Laura. And Laura, Marion Halcombe is a fascinating character, because the relationship that kind of really jumped out of it for me was this: they were half sisters, and it was the tenderness and the commitment and the passion with which Marion tries to help her actually less able, less amazing half-sister to be restored and kind of redeemed in a way. So I don't want to give you a plot summary, but I hadn't quite realised what it was that really about Marion that really made me kind of turn the light on for me. And when I was reading, just as a sort of preparation, and I knew I couldn't read the whole book, the first thing I double clicked on was gender bender. Now I didn't realise this at the time, but first off, Marion's looks are emphasised a lot. Perhaps overemphasized. She's got a hot bod, so she's got a great figure, according to Walter and Fosco, that's a couple of the characters. But you'd think she'd got the head of Medusa the way people act around her. So here's a quote. Never was the old conventional maxim that nature cannot err more flatly contradicted. Never was the fair promise of a lovely figure more strangely and startlingly belied by the face and head that crowned it. So this is Marion, poor Marion. The lady's complexion was almost swarthy. The dark down on her upper lip was almost a moustache. She had a large, firm, masculine mouth and jaw. And I hadn't even remembered that, but I knew I liked her already. So Marion verges on being outright masculine in her looks, and that's reflected in her behaviour too. Marion even describes herself as unfeminine. She's intelligent, she likes chess and arguing, she probably likes to talk a lot, and she can't do those typically feminine female things like play the piano or draw. So she was appealing to me, she turned the light on, but it was really this relationship between her and her half-sister. It wasn't actually the romance in this book that got me, because the romance was typically heterosexual. But it was so typical of the way that my generation, or at least people brought up in Christchurch and very sort of middle-class backgrounds, had to go and mine for anything that kind of spoke to them about their identity or about their evolving. So it was a matter of reading between the lines or reading into the lines your story, placing your passion, your commitment to sort of same. Really, in a way. And that's what I was exploring at the time. Now, it did take me many more years to actually fully turn the light on. In fact, I was 33 before I married to an Anglican minister, I have to admit, before I really switched that neon light on properly and fell out of the closet. But the thing is that already I was looking to find the traces of the stories that I could relate to, the stories that touched me. And in a way, I was surprised. I thought, surely this is Wilkie Collins. Surely he must know he's writing a lesbian relationship here. And he must do that. And the thing is, they lived happily ever after. And maybe that's what I thought my marriage, perhaps that's what I thought that was going to happen. But obviously it didn't, which was a good thing. I could say that. But the thing is that, in a way, I was looking for those readings. I was looking for those stories. And I don't think they were there in the same way in the 1970s as they are now. I'm sure that's the truth. And in a way, I had to find my stories in stories that were basically written for someone else. They were other love stories. They were other detective stories. They were other things. There might have been a lot more people reading The Well of Loneliness, but in Christchurch at Mariehaugh High School, they did not give that as the prize for geography. So, and I know you'll be surprised about that. But when I did read something that was more, finally I found, and maybe I had some, I was homophobic. You know, I mean, I probably hated myself, I'm sure. But, I mean, when I bought these books, I actually had to sneak in. And I didn't want anyone to see me because I thought, other women. You know, I mean, this was the 1970s where you didn't even touch someone. You know, even if they fell over, you left them there on the side. You know, you just, especially if they were the same sex, you just let them die. That was fine. You just in case someone thought you might be a lesbian or gay. So, but this is in Christchurch, I have to say. But so other women, I struggled to buy this book because it was, because I already knew that it had some sort of, you know, because I'd already read the one before, which I also struggled to buy, but I bought that book more by accident. But this, this one, this is kind of typical of, I think, the books that you could read, that were about, same-sex relationships and particularly women's same-sex relationships, which I think have always been more problematic and perhaps more deeply, kind of difficult for society. But I don't want to read the whole thing. But basically, the woman that sort of thinks that she could be lesbian or thinks that she has these difficult relationships with other women, and she goes into therapy. And you'll be really pleased to know she was cured pretty much by the end of it. So I think that that's the other kind. And that's partly why, because I was always disappointed. They always came right in the end. You know, they were always more or less cured. So it was kind of, you know, just give me a whack when I need to go. Okay. So it's all right. Yeah. Okay. So I think so. It's time.
1 minute.
Okay. Right. Okay. Well, really, I think that's the two things. I think that I had to read and find those stories and other stories that were conventionally written or intended for another audience. And then when I did find those stories that traced parts and aspects of that passionate relationship between two women, it was always portrayed in a negative way. It was always framed as a pathology, as problematic, or the ones that I was reading. And so I think that left my life very much more confused than it turned the light on. Because I think the books we were reading, in some ways, were not actually helping direct us to new stories, to possible future stories for ourselves. It finally did dawn the light. But these are the stories that I look back on as formative in that process. So look, thank you very much. I hope.
To stand is not compulsory. If you have something wrong with your legs, I'm more than happy to come and sit on them. I'm sure you'll stand extremely quickly then. Thank you, Joe. Next up, we've got Paul Diamond. Paul is a writer, he's a journalist and a broadcaster and curator Māori at the Turnbull Library. His books include Makiriti, a biography of Maggie Papakura, and he's looked at the fascinatingly murky world of the mayor of Whanganui, who in the 1920s was dumped from office for making a pass at the poet Darcy Cresswell. The ex-mayor was later shot on the streets of Berlin. It's a movie waiting to happen, and we hope that Paul writes it. Ladies and gentlemen, make some noise for Paul.
Well, kia ora koutou. It's wonderful that this is happening, and it was even more exciting to be asked to be part of it. And Joe doesn't need to feel embarrassed about having two books. I've actually got three, but mainly talking about one. And I guess I need to sort of preface what I'm going to tell you about these books about a bit of context about the time that I'm talking about. And I guess it's the time when I was coming out. So we're talking about the late 80s and the early 90s, which for someone born in 1968 is a bit of a late run. But for those of you who can't remember that as clearly as I can, you know, it was a very different sort of landscape. Legally, it was very different. There were no civil partnerships. There was no marriage. There was no legal protection. It was before, really just on the cusp of decriminalisation. And as a result, the social attitudes were really different. And it wasn't as commonplace, I guess bordering on banal actually at times, as things are now. And in the Hutt Valley, where I was growing up, it was like it didn't exist. And the gap between these books I'm going to tell you about and what I'd grown up with was really, really, really large. Because if you had role models at all, they were either ridiculous or tragic and violent. So you had John Inman as Mr. Humphreys on Are You Being Served? Because in New Zealand then, well, there was initially one channel, two channels, then three, but everyone watched the same things. So there was that. And then there was Hudson and Hall's locally here, but it was like they were not completely real, especially in Stokes Valley and in the Hutt Valley. Or there was my mother's cousin who was a theatre nurse and who would sort of murmur, you know, they'd have these murmured conversations about tragic relationships that ended in violence in the A&E department on a Saturday night in the Hutt Hospital. So there was that sort of vague sense. But overall, the message was, well, it was never really spoken, but the idea was, if you go down that path, you're letting yourself into a sad, lonely, tragic life. So it was a revelation to find out about books that showed other ways of being. And I guess, those things that were around in the period when you do come out, I guess do have a very big influence on you. And so many, many people will be familiar with this, Dangerous Desires, which has P.E. Diamond, Wellington, 1992, which was when I was flatting in Wellington, and it really was one of those cases of, I think everyone else had figured that this man should come out before he did. But so again, it was a late run. But when I sort of got to it, this had just come out. And I remember sitting in my bedroom at my flat in Haitaito, being too nervous to take it to the lounge, reading it. And it was a revelation. And just this idea that there were these other sort of realities, that it was not necessarily tragic, and sometimes there were even happy endings. And they were different lives to mine. I mean, they weren't set in the Hutt Valley, but it was still inspiring, different sorts of role models. And then I have a friend in Wellington who's the same age as me but came out 10 years before me, so I like to think of him as my sort of fairy godmother, because it was a case of, I mean, he was responsible for my cultural education in those early years, and we both grew up in the Hutt Valley, but he was a lot more worldly than I was then. So he said, haven't you heard of Armstead Mopen? And haven't you heard of the Tales of the City? And, you know, so it was all this catching up that I had to do. So wolf those down, and they are, I know a woman who reads the Nancy Mitford trilogy, The Pursuit of Love, and the other two books in that series. She reads those every now and again. I read The Tales of the City every now and again. I just sort of, when I need a boost, those are the books I go back to. And that was about this whole different imagining of urban living and different sorts of people living together in a place like Barbary Lane. So that was exciting. But then what was another project that Peter Wells had a lot to do with? Best Mates, Gay Writing in Aotearoa, New Zealand. This wonderful anthology, very brave book. There's a whole story, a lot of people here will know about it, about the use of the Winckelmann image on the cover, and then the bravery about highlighting the work of those three, well, the non-appearance of the work by those three writers whose literary executors wouldn't allow it to be included in that anthology then. But for me personally, one of the most significant things about this book, and if you haven't, I know it won't be in print, I guess, but it's a wonderful, wonderful book for lots of reasons. But for me personally, it was when I came across this story that was alluded to, this little paragraph. If one looks back to the 1920s, one comes across what looks like a typical literary and sexual conundrum. Darcy Creswell, who's lived from 1896 to 1960, was a Canterbury-born poet who was as famous for the ornateness of his poetry as he was for going door-to-door during the Depression and hocking off his poems. Before this, however, in 1920, he had acted as a homosexual agent provocateur. He'd lured the mayor of Whanganui into homosexual indiscretion in the local art gallery. The mayor, in desperation, attempted to murder Creswell. This led to the remarkable osmosis by which the mayor of a small yet rather elegant riverside city in New Zealand lost his name, his fortune, his country. We next find him a communist journalist in the gay mecca of Berlin, where he was shot by the police. This dramatic trajectory hints at the extraordinary lives of some earlier homosexuals who were pushed beyond silence and discretion. So I read that, and that was sort of fizzing away in my head. And then when Gareth, Roger and I were working at Radio New Zealand together, Prue Langbein, who is a drama producer there, had just read about this in Michael King's History of New Zealand. She said, have you heard about that Whanganui mayor and that story? And I said, oh, yeah, no, I'd known about it earlier because of this. And she said, well, why don't we make a radio program? So we decided to make a radio program and had it commissioned. The trouble was there was really no one to talk to, because it had happened in 1920. Everyone was dead except for the mayor's daughter, who, because I was a coward, I got Prue to ring her. And she said, stop this at once. Who's your boss? So, but we did get a sense that she was very protective of her father. So we sort of, oh, we've got no one to interview. But we started going through the archives, and in the meantime, I left radio and started working at the Ministry for Culture and Heritage, where my boss was the chief historian, Bronwyn Daly, who's actually an expert in history of sexuality and crime. And she's from Whanganui, like actually quite a lot of historians are. And she said to me, don't try and solve this, but look at the effect it had on other gay men in Whanganui and in New Zealand. And then you suddenly start to see all of these New Zealand gay men popping up in London and other parts of Europe in the 20s. So Bronwyn's suggestion was, you know, was this used as a way of keeping men in line, like behave, or look what happened to the mayor of Whanganui. It's hard to imagine how rich and prosperous and significant Whanganui was then. It's kind of like an amalgam of Hamilton and Palmerston, but more elegant then. But in terms of its economic clout, then it was a hugely powerful thing. So I think it really did rattle people. So the other reason it was a bit tricky to work out what to do with this is there's so many kind of angles to it. The mayor said in court that he'd been treated for his homosexuality, which looks like it was hypnosis, and a thing called autosuggestion, which was quite popular in 1914. And there's also this obliteration of his name. So in Whanganui, they sanded his name off the Sargent Gallery, they destroyed his portrait, his wife and daughters all changed their name back to the maiden name. He's written out of the histories of Whanganui. Now he's probably actually Whanganui does have quite a few extreme mayors, but now a historian there said he's actually become a bit of a cult. But it's great to be able to be here actually to acknowledge there's various people here who've supported me and encouraged me in this. My boss at the Turnbull Library teases me that this is my life's work. I'm hoping that I do finish it before my life is over. I'm actually going to be going to Germany after Easter to spend a bit more time chasing Charles Mackey and perhaps Darcy Creswell as well. There is an essay in the books that Carol's got out there about the war, telling the story from the point of view of the Great War, which actually goes a long way to explain how the two guys connected and possibly a motivation, because no one's ever been able to prove that. How did Darcy Creswell know that the mayor was gay and be able to confront him and say, resign or else, and then the mayor shot him? But the challenge that I'm up against at the moment is to finish this darn book, and so it would be quite inspiring if at a future same but different conference in the not too distant future I was actually able to stand here and tell you about the actual book. Kia ora.
Thank you, Paul. Okay, number three, we've got Susanna Walker. Susanna is the editor of the Metro magazine, which is a seminal position of power in Auckland's Queen City. It is a great pleasure to have her here speaking. Please, make some noise for Susanna.
I'm actually on deadline, in the throes of deadline at the moment, which means my mind has been fully occupied with that and will be this weekend. But so what I have done is just at the very earliest hours of the morning have flung down my story, I guess, in part, and also not that it's a competition, but three magazines and one book that turn the light on. We might be up to 20 by then. Yeah, so if you'll forgive me the less, the more formal style, I've just got to read what I hope makes sense. It's 1979, and I'm 13 years old. I live in Inglewood, population 3,000, in the shadow of Mount Taranaki. Nothing ever happens, except for a murder, now and then. I'm in the third form at Inglewood High School. I'm consistently good at English, and I totally suck at maths. I'm a dreamer who reads while everyone else my age seems to be playing sport. And I have one favourite, in fact the only, on-trend outfit, which I wear as much as I possibly can, a pair of skin jeans. Anyone my age might remember those. You had to lie on your bed to get the zip up. And a boob tube. Needless to say, those days are gone. I'm not allowed to get my ears pierced because Mum thinks it's common. But I compensate with an aggressive middle part and Farrah Fawcett flicks. I'm the fourth of five children. Mum's an artist, but in 1979 she is swamped by the demands of motherhood. Dad's the company secretary for a dairy company. I don't know what that means, so I just tell people he's an accountant. Our house is directly opposite Dad's office. He just has to cross the road and he's at work. He likes to pop home for a nice piece of homemade ginger slice and a cuppa and a listen to the national program on the Bakelite radio, which sits on the lowest shelf of one of our many bookcases. My mother is a voracious reader. My father isn't. But sometimes he gets a copy of Playboy for Christmas, as a joke. A lot changes when I'm 13. My sterling career as a brownie is in the past now. I was in the Fairies Club, whatever a sub-tribe of brownies is called, and Brown Owl just loved it when we chanted our motto, "I'm a fairy, good and gay." Helping others every day. Eventually I graduate to Girl Guides, but once I'm a teenager I leave all that shit behind. However, I still have my Girl Guide box, so to speak. The box is what you put your stuff in when you're forced to go to Girl Guide camps, because clearly a suitcase is far too easy. One's box is homemade to exacting Girl Guide specifications. Dad conjures one up in the garage and Mum neatly inscribes my name in white on the lid. It's in the Girl Guide box, which now sits gathering dust under the desk in my bedroom, that I hide Dad's Playboy after stealing it from the top of his wardrobe. Today I can only recall one image from that magazine, but I remember it very vividly. It's a double-page spread of an orgy. There are at least 20 men and women, naked, sprawling, writhing, sucking, stroking, and entering in every possible configuration. It's deeply shocking and profoundly exciting, and I spend a great deal of time in my room pondering the ins and outs of it all. It turns my light on. And then I go and stay with my best friend, Linda. She's just around the corner, and I go and stay there for the weekend. I'm getting kind of bored with Linda, actually, because she's still mad about horses, and I've moved on. Going to stay at Linda's is a bit of a treat because it gives me a break from the one activity I'm permitted to do without parental supervision, attend a rabid Christian youth group. So after a weekend of watching Linda ride her pony, I tear myself away to find Gran, visiting from the big smoke of New Plymouth, has taken it upon herself to give my bedroom a jolly good clean up. Of course, she has rooted around in the Girl Guide box. And of course, she found the Playboy. Proving you're never too old to be a dauber, Gran tells my parents. For years, they delight in making oblique references while I writhe in embarrassment. Thankfully, the orgy's already seared on my brain when my crime is unmasked, so I can return to it any time I want without fear of being found out. It's an amusing anecdote to share with you tonight, but I wonder now about that merging of sex and shame back when I was 13 years old and how that shaped me. But two more illuminating magazines were to follow. At 14, I'm curled up in the Lazy Boy with Mum's new copy of The Listener when I come across a story about a youthful yodeling duo from Huntley. Oh, I've never read anything about lesbians before, or, as far as I know, laid eyes on any either. I reckon the top twins look, in 1980s parlance, ultra cool and spunky. Then Mum walks in and sees what I'm reading. "They do things to each other, you know," she mutters darkly. By the time the top twins arrived, courtesy of The Listener, I was a budding feminist, despite there being no books on the subject in the Inglewood Public Library. It was simply a kind of knowing. Kissing boys may have been my favourite hobby at the time, but men ran most things in my world, and I didn't like it. I don't recall how I came across Broadsheet, New Zealand's monthly feminist magazine, but I asked for and received a subscription for my 16th birthday. I think we can safely assume I was the only subscriber in Inglewood at the time. Broadsheet published my dreadful poetry, but most importantly, it gave me access to a world I could actually relate to. I felt different to my friends, and not just because I was determined not to be a farmer's wife. And then there was a book. According to my memory, I read it when I was 18, the year I left home for the bright lights of Palmerston North. A couple of weeks back, in Taranaki for the weekend, I found this book in my parents' bookcase, Running Backwards Over Sand, a novel by the New Zealander Stephanie Dowrick, who co-founded the Women's Press in London during the 70s. Turning its pages, I discovered it was in fact published in 1986 when I was 20. Mum's name and our old Inglewood address are written on the flyleaf. Until last week, I hadn't read this book for 30 years, but as with Playboy, I had retained a single vivid image. Despite it being primarily about the course of a heterosexual relationship, what I remembered was a sex scene between two women. Exotic, confident Claudine, I even remembered her name, and an avowed lesbian, and previously heterosexual Zoe, a young woman from a small New Zealand town in the throes of discovery, self-discovery. The sex was explicit and consuming and joyous for all three of us. It was the first time I'd read about women fucking and it blew my mind. I like to think, looking back down the decades, that Running Backwards Over Sand served as a kind of roadmap for me, for what was possible. Within months, I left New Zealand for the first time on my own small town girl's self-discovery mission, and I met my first female lover. Returning from overseas just before my 21st birthday, I clomped off the plane in New Plymouth in my Doc Martens, sporting a buzz cut with the bristles dyed blue-black. "You look like a blowfly," hissed Mum. Charming. She then refused to speak to me for 3 days. When talks resumed, she told me the buzz cut was not the only thing that had shocked her when I got off that plane. "It was as if you had lesbian tattooed across your forehead," she said. It wasn't until last week, rereading Running Backwards Over Sand, that I realised my mother hadn't come up with that immortal line herself. She had lifted it straight from this book. Page 319, to be precise. Thanks.
Oh, thank you, Susanna. Okay, speaker number four is Douglas Lloyd Jenkins. Douglas Lloyd Jenkins is a design historian who reintroduced modernism to New Zealand through At Home, a century of New Zealand design. He's always got a definite point of view, something that scares the wits out of most people, but at least he knows what he's talking about. Please, ladies and gentlemen, Douglas Lloyd Jenkins.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you for being here, and thank you for the invitation. I'm in an interesting position of being, of course, the partner of the festival director, but I was saying to another writer, I've never been invited to a writers' conference that he wasn't the festival director of, so I'm very pleased to be here. This is about a particular light going on, and I suppose it's about that realisation that you can have an opinion and you won't die from it. This story is set in the English department in Auckland University in the 1990s, and I can't help but notice that there are two lecturers from that department in the room, so all names have been removed and you can play a guessing game. In the early 1990s, I returned to university to complete a degree that I'd earlier abandoned, and as part of this, I had to complete some English literature papers, and I remember talking to the head of department and begging that I didn't have to do linguistics because I had no intention of carrying on in English literature in any way, and which is a bit strange since I became a writer. I'd come back to finish an abandoned first degree and then to get a second degree that would allow me to teach in a tertiary design school, which is where I was then working. I was a little bit older than most students, but not significantly so, and I wasn't yet what I later learnt was called a cow, a conscientious older woman student. Those people that ask questions when the teenagers would just like the tutorial to end. In my first round at university, I hadn't been very interested in writing or writing essays, but more in the romance and the drinking and the parties. And most essays were written the night before they were due, when the only book you could get from the library on the subject had been published in 1936, because everyone else had got theirs out months ago. Part of the reading for this new English department course was My Antonia by the American writer Willa Cather, of whom I then knew nothing. And I'll just read the little blurb off the back. An enduring classic, My Antonia is the unforgettable story of an immigrant woman's life on the hard scrabble Nebraska plains, through Jim Burden's affectionate reminiscence of his childhood friend, the free-spirited Antonia Shimera. A larger, uniquely American portrait emerges, both of a community struggling with unforgiving terrain and of a woman who, amid great hardship, stands as a timeless inspiration. Willa Cather is a writer of what's become known as the Prairie novel, and if you've never read her, they're simple, beautiful, lyrical, lovely, lovely novels. And this is her breakthrough novel, and it first appeared in 1915. And I read this today. It was initially credited with revealing to America that the people of the Midwest had interior lives when American literature was focused on the East Coast, or was better still, living and working in England. I quite like that idea that, you know, this is this period where the people in the Midwest, and maybe we still think of them as sort of ciphers. Anyway, I'd pretty much gone through school resenting, and I still do, resent being made to read anything. In particular, when I was a young person, it's because I had I was a strong reader, and I read a lot, and I didn't like being told to put down what I was reading by a teacher to read what they wanted me to read. So usually I just really read enough of the book, and even went to Cole's Notes just to pass the exam. My engineer changed all that. It's a story told retrospectively of a young orphan boy growing up in Nebraska, and his observations of a young bohemian girl who's 4 years older than him, called Antonia. It's full of difficult emotional territory and some tragic stuff. Antonia's father commits suicide because of his homesickness, and it's full of rural hardship and misery. But the one thing that excited my imagination is that the book has two stories within stories. And one of these is the story of Peter and Pavel. And I'm going to tell you the story in my own words, because I'll explain why a little bit later. The way I saw it, Peter and Pavel were two incredibly handsome young Russian boys who grew up together being madly in love. And one of them announced one day that he was going to marry, and the other one said, well, you know, yeah, that's okay, I'll be your best man. They were married. He married this girl. And on the way home from the wedding, they were riding a sleigh through the snow, and they are attacked by wolves. And they throw all the luggage overboard, but the pack of wolves is chasing them, and they realise that they are going to be destroyed by the wolves, so they chuck the bride over. She's eaten by the wolves, and they ride off to America. Now, the important thing that I only realised today is that's not what happens in the book. It's close, but it's not quite. But that's the story I've had in my brain for 25 years, so I'm sticking with it for the minute. So if there's any Cather scholars in the room, and I know there is one, sorry about that. It excited me because the novel seemed to be about Cather suggesting there were possibilities in life, and that if you looked around in the community that you lived, people were doing and thinking differently, and you could latch onto them or understand their model. And this might not have meant very much, except the university question list popped onto my was handed out, and it said, "Discuss the importance of gender and sexuality in My Antonia." And I still do not know what to this day what answer they were expecting to that question, but it obviously wasn't mine. I decided for the first time in my life that I would write a queer interpretation of the novel. And I'd never really done anything like it. It was a literary coming out and a dive into scary territory. So not only did I read the novel twice, I did what was then called a close reading, which universities probably still are very fond of close readings. But not only did this, did I read My Engineer, I read O Pioneers and the strangely titled One of Ours that precede it, and the major novels that post-date it, The Professor's House and The Death Come for the Archbishop, which I found a lovely gay couple of two Catholic priests who live happily together, and I would recommend that's a lovely book. I scoured My Engineer and I discovered by cross-referencing that with the then new Ellman biography of Oscar Wilde that the town in Nebraska in which the novel set is the very town that Wilde had passed through on his American House Beautiful tour, and he had used it to pose for photographs behind bars in the local jail. So lovely reference there. I even correlated certain phrases Kathy used against the writings of Freud, so I really was going deep. I remember dealing with the kiss between Jim and Antonia that many saw as the climax of the novel and describing it as a lifeless peck that had been overhyped by heterosexual interpreters. I thought I was pretty growing up. Today I read Katha's scholar saying that Katha very rarely represents a heterosexual relationship that has any romance or sexual glow to it, so I don't feel so bad about that sentence now. We're talking the early 90s, and Katha was then a mystery figure. She had on her death insisted on the destruction of all her personal papers, and very few critics or writers were then exploring what is now pretty widely accepted, that Katha was a lesbian. Then you could only deal with phrases like she was intensely private, she was unmarried, and she burnt all her private papers. And you had to join the dots together, which left you pretty wide open. There was a little help, and I found a book called A Life Saved Up by Hermione Lee, which helped, and I wrote my essay. I dropped it in the lecturer's box. I waited for a few days, got on with my life, and then it came with a big round circle and a giant and enormous C minus. The very mark that the drunken party boy used to get when he was in stage one for essays churned out overnight. There were also some pretty weird comments written on it. One said, I suspect Katha was never dim enough to fall for Freud. Hermione Lee is a dangerous woman. Be careful. And most repeatedly, really? ? I was completely devastated because I felt I'd been serious but not taken seriously. So I decided to take the paper to the convener of the course and asked her to read it. She did, and she passed it around some other department people and came back and said to me, lovely to my ears, that's an A+ in my class and an A- from another colleague. She also secretly and quietly said, you did give this to the worst possible person in the department. So fired up, I made an appointment to see the lecturer who'd marked it, and when I rang, he said, oh yes, I was expecting this call. So the day came for my appointment and I got there early. I'm always punctual. I sat there until the exact second of the appointment time. I had all the novels, all the books, all the post-it marks, all the references. I knocked on the door. The voice said, come, as they do, come. I opened the door, tripped over the carpet, fell sprawling headfirst into the room, dropping all my books on the papers on the floor, only to realise that the room was occupied by another student. I was made to pick up my papers and go sit outside and sweat for another 10 minutes. Eventually, I got my piece and we argued point by point. The only concession I recall making was that it was agreed that Peter and Pavel, once they did move to Nebraska, did share a bed. And I remember having to prove it by finding the page reference. He agreed to reconsider the piece, and it came back to me a fortnight later with another big red circle and the grade B-. I didn't go further, but I realised that writing gay hadn't destroyed me, it had made me. And there's just a little epilogue. Years later, I met Hermione Lee, and by then a major literary biographer, and I was able to tell her she'd once been described as a dangerous woman. She loved it. 20 years later, the same lecturer contacted me by email out of the blue to ask a question about my professional life in the museum. And he started off saying, I realise we still disagree about that essay. And I thought, 20 years later and it's still bugging him. How many essays has that guy read? And mine's still playing on his mind. And I said to him, I consider that to be one of the most important moments in my life because it realised I had a voice of my own and I thank you for it. I subsequently wrote every university essay seriously but not always with a queer point of view, and I developed a queer sensibility in my own writing that is still there today. As a lecturer, I also realised a very important thing, that the B- is the perfect grade. No student ever complains about one. And though it was in that moment writing about Willa Cather that I learned that I could write as a homosexual or as a gay man, it took me another 20 years to realise it was okay to dress like one. Thank you.
Nice work. Next up we have Paula Bock. Paula is what's known as a great all-rounder, a one-time cricket player for Otago, the founder of the Long Acre Press, and award-winning author of the young adult's novels Dear Truth or Promise and Out Walked Mel. She's also writing and producing some great television stories. Please, ladies and gentlemen, Paula Bock.
Thank you very much. Kia ora katoa. Some familiar faces in this audience, so it's very nice to see some of you again, some of you after a long time. And I'm very privileged to be on this panel of such talented and interesting people, and lots of chimes for me so far in what other people have said. I remember Susanna coming back in 1981 from England, having left as a young long-haired hippie in some dress from Frangipani or some shop in Dunedin like that, and arriving back with a buzz cut and a Pakistani Liberation Front scarf and a beret, and walking straight past my father walked straight past me, didn't know who I was, and I was a bridesmaid in my brother's wedding the very next week, and we all wore hats. I have sort of approached this slightly differently because there was for me no book that turned the light on. There was a light that turned the book on, but there was no book that I remember, and I'd stood in front of my bookshelves scanning them, because like other people, like Paul for example, growing up in the South Island in the 1970s, 1960s, 1970s, they're really, really, I came out before literature came out, really, for me. There was no literature that led me there. I went looking for resonances. I went looking for code. And we're all very good at code, aren't we? And when I look back, it's actually my childhood reading that always has those resonances for me. And there were two books that I want to talk about briefly, quickly. So the first one is this little book called The Adventures of Pinocchio. You know it. And I know what you're thinking. Is it the nose that grows uncontrollably that makes this queer literature? Is it that it's a boy made of wood? No. Well, not for me, although you can, of course, take what you like from books because it's all about what you put into them, which is one of the reasons I like being a reader, and I also love being a writer. The book is interpreted so differently by everybody, and I'm sure that Carlo Collodi never expected anyone to find in Pinocchio what I did. But it's there. It took me years to work out why this book I found so compelling, so distracting, actually so disturbing and moving. And years later, I realised when I read on the cover, The Marionette Who Wanted to Be a Real Boy. I was the girl who wanted to be a real boy. And as a child, Well, there was no gay, no queer references really in my life, so queer wasn't part of it. It was more about gender. That's how it came out. And aside from Mr. Humphreys on Are You Being Served and Hudson and Halls, really, there was no reference. I had no words, I had no characters, I had no stories to reflect the sense I had very early on, of being different. But writers, thank God, are very good about writing about misfits. And I wanted to be a real boy. I went to bed every night praying that I would wake up a real boy, just like Pinocchio. Pinocchio didn't actually become a real boy, mainly because the marionette, and I'm assuming you all know the story, I'm not going to tell you, because he was so naughty and selfish, and he went off and he did things like he sold his school book to go to the theatre, which sounds like an extremely reasonable thing to do. And he ran off with a friend called, was one version Candlewick, but I remembered it as Lampwick, to Toyland, where they just played together forever, for about 5 months, I think, until they both started to grow donkey's ears. But if it was only a matter of being good and not turning into a donkey, I thought I would have become a real boy 100 times over. The disappointment in Pinocchio wasn't that he kept getting it wrong and didn't turn into a real boy, and that he kept, by his true nature, getting into more and more impossible scrapes. It wasn't that was disappointing. The most disappointing thing about this book, and the reason it's niggled me for years and years, is that he did become a real boy. Pinocchio, unlike all of us who identified with him, he was granted his wish by the blue-haired fairy, I must add, and he was transformed, but he was transformed into what, and you can see how disappointed I was by what he got transformed into. He got transformed into the most conformist, boring, straight, heteronormative little, pissy little boy that you've ever seen. And dear little Pinocchio, the marionette, is there broken and discarded on the floor on the last page of this book. And Pinocchio turned and looked at the marionette for a little while, and he said to himself contentedly, "How ridiculous I was when I was a marionette, and how glad I am that I've become a real boy. I was so pissed off. For years that niggled me. I didn't want to be that boy. Not that boy." And of course, that book's not about sexuality. It's not really about the light being turned on. It's about me searching for the light, really. It is the clearest way I had at that time of describing my sense of difference, and that came out as a dissatisfaction with my gender. It's probably more about the rules of gender in the 1960s and 70s than gender per se. But the next wonderful thing that happened was the discovery of my next book, perhaps the most significant book that cranked up that light in my life as a child, and it was this most derided of books, The Famous Five. And you know who I'm talking about, don't you? Because just like Friends in the 1990s or Harry Potter now, if you had a Facebook page back in 1974, it would be, "Which Famous Five are you?" George. Dear George. Dear, dear George. I'm just going to read you. This is the very first of the books. And this is when Anne meets George. And we all know about Anne. She was a complete sop. And all she wanted to do was dolls and clean and cook and look after the boys and make her mother happy, and she was sort of slightly below Timmy in my list of which Famous Five character you were like. But when she met her, she called her Georgina, and she said, George says, "I am not Georgina. I'm George," said the girl. "I shall only answer if you call me George. I hate being a girl." I won't be. I don't like doing the things that girls do. I like doing the things that boys do. I can climb better than any boy and swim further too. I can sail a boat as far as any fisher boy on this coast. You're to call me George, and then I'll speak to you. But I shan't if you don't. Thank God for George. She saw me through.